Random House Audiobooks presents Eaters of the Dead by Michael Crichton. Read for you by Victor Garber, with commentary provided by Michael Crichton.
The Ibn Fadlan manuscript is the earliest known eyewitness account of Viking life and society. It's an extraordinary document describing in vivid detail events which occurred more than 1,000 years ago. The manuscript has not, of course, survived intact over that enormous span of time. In June AD 921, the Caliph of Baghdad sent a member of his court, Ahmad ibn Fadlan, as ambassador to the King of the Bulgars. Ibn Fadlan was gone 3 years on his journey, and he never actually accomplished his mission, because along the way he encountered a company of Norsemen, and he had many adventures among them. When he finally returned to Baghdad, Ibn Fadlan recorded his experiences in an official report to the court. That original manuscript has long since disappeared, and to reconstruct it, we have to rely on partial fragments preserved in later sources. The task of collating these many versions and translations, ranging over more than 1,000 years and appearing in Arabic, Latin, German, French, Danish, Swedish, and English, is an undertaking of formidable proportions. Only a person of great erudition and energy would even attempt it, and in 1951 such a person did. Per Fraus Dolus, Professor Emeritus of Comparative Literature at the University of Oslo in Norway, compiled all the known sources and began the massive task of translation which occupied him until his death in 1957. In preparing this full and annotated version of the Fraus Dolus translation, I myself have made few alterations. I deleted some repetitive passages, and I altered the original syntax so that the meaning is clearer. Ibn Fadlan's portrait of the Vikings differs markedly from the traditional view of these people. The first European descriptions of the Vikings were recorded by clergy. They were the only people at the time who could write, and they viewed the pagan Northmen with special horror. Here is a typically hyperbolic passage cited by D.M. Wilson from a 12th century Irish writer. In a word, although there were 100 hard-steeled iron heads on one neck, and 100 sharp, ready, cool, never-rusting brazen tongues in each head, they could not recount or narrate, enumerate or tell what all the Irish suffered in every house from those valiant, wrathful, purely pagan people. Modern scholars recognize that these blood-curdling accounts of the Vikings are vastly exaggerated. Yet European writers still tend to dismiss the Scandinavians as bloody barbarians, irrelevant to the main flow of Western culture. This situation is understandable only if we recognize a long-standing European bias. Every Western schoolchild dutifully learns that the Near East is the cradle of civilization. From here, civilization spread to Crete and Greece, then to Rome, and eventually to the barbarians of Northern Europe. What these barbarians were doing while they waited for the arrival of civilization was not known, nor was the question often asked. We should recognize, first of all, that what we call the Vikings were scattered in individual parties of seafarers who came from a vast geographical area, Scandinavia is larger than Portugal, Spain, and France combined, and who sailed from their individual feudal states for the purpose of trade or piracy or both. In fact, for a people who lack civilization, the Vikings demonstrate remarkably sustained and purposeful behavior. As proof of widespread trading, Arabic coins appear in Scandinavia as early as AD 692. During the next 400 years, Viking trader pirates expanded as far west as Newfoundland, as far south as Sicily and Greece, and as far east as the Ural Mountains of Russia, where their traders linked up to caravans arriving from the Silk Routes of China. The Vikings were not empire builders, and it's popular to say that their influence across this vast area was impermanent. Yet it was sufficiently permanent to lend place names to many localities in England, while to Russia they gave the very name of the nation itself, from the Norse tribe Rus. As for the more subtle influence of pagan vigor, relentless energy, and their system of values, the manuscript of Ibn Fadlan shows us how many typically Norse attitudes have been preserved to the present day. We should say something about Ibn Fadlan, the man who speaks to us with such a distinctive voice, despite the passage of more than 1,000 years and the filter of translators from 12 linguistic and cultural traditions. We know almost nothing about him personally. Apparently he was educated, and from his exploits, he could not have been very old. He states explicitly that he is a familiar of the caliph, whom he did not particularly admire. In this he was not alone, for the caliph was twice deposed and finally slain by one of his own officers. Of his society, we know more. In the 10th century, Baghdad, the city of peace, was the most civilized city on earth. More than 1 million inhabitants lived within its famous circular walls. It was the focus of intellectual and commercial excitement in an environment of extraordinary grace, elegance, and splendor. There were perfumed gardens, cool, shady arbors, and the accumulated riches of a vast empire. The Arabs of Baghdad were Muslim and fiercely dedicated to that religion, but they were also exposed to people who looked, acted, and believed very differently from them. The Arabs were, in fact, the least provincial people in the world at that time. Ibn Fadlan himself is clearly an observant man, and he reports what he sees with remarkably little condescension. His manner of reporting may seem eccentric to Western sensibilities. He doesn't tell a story as we're accustomed to hearing one. We tend to forget that our own sense of drama originates in an oral tradition. Our oldest stories, the Iliad, Beowulf, the Song of Roland, were all intended to be sung by singers whose chief function and first obligation was entertainment. But Ibn Fadlan was a writer, and his principal aim was not entertainment. On the contrary, he was an ambassador delivering a report. His tone is that of a tax auditor. Indeed, he often slights the most exciting elements of his narrative rather than let them interfere with his clear and level-headed account. At times, this dispassion is so irritating we fail to recognize how extraordinary a spectator he really is. For hundreds of years after Ibn Fadlan, the tradition among travelers was to write wildly speculative, fanciful chronicles of foreign marvels, talking animals, feathered men who flew, encounters with behemoths and unicorns, and so on. But Ibn Fadlan never speculates. Every word rings true, and whenever he reports by hearsay, he is careful to say so. He is equally careful to specify when he's an eyewitness. That's why he uses the phrase, "I saw with my own eyes," over and over. In the end, it is the quality of absolute truthfulness which makes his tale so horrifying. For his encounter with the monsters of the mist, the eaters of the dead, is told with the same attention to detail, the same careful skepticism that marks other portions of his manuscript. In any case, the listener may judge for himself. I will offer comments only to clarify particulars in the story that may be mystifying to modern ears.
Eaters of the Dead. The departure from the City of Peace. Praise be to God, the merciful, the compassionate, the Lord of the two worlds. And blessing and peace upon the Prince of Prophets, our Lord and Master Muhammad, whom God bless and preserve with abiding and continuing peace and blessings until the day of the faith. This is the book of Ahmad ibn Fadlan, ibn al-Abbas, ibn Rasid, ibn Hamad, a client of Muhammad ibn Suleiman, the ambassador from al-Muqtadir to the king of the Sakaliba, in which he recounts what he saw in the land of the Turks, the Hazars, the Sakaliba, the Baskirs, the Rus, and the Northmen. The letter of the Yiltuwar, king of the Sakaliba, reached the commander of the faithful, al-Muqtadir. He asked him therein to send someone who would instruct him in religion and make him acquainted with the laws of Islam, who would build for him a mosque and erect for him a pulpit from which might be carried out the mission of converting his people in all the districts of his kingdom, and also for advice in the construction of fortifications and defense works. And he prayed the caliph to do these things. The commander of the faithful al-Muqtadir, as many know, was not a strong and just caliph, but drawn to pleasures and the flattering speeches of his officers, who played him the fool and jested mightily behind his back. I was not of this company, for the reason that follows. In the City of Peace lived an elderly merchant of the name Ibn Quarin. He hoarded his gold and likewise his young wife, whom none had ever seen. On a certain day, the Caliph sent me to deliver to Ibn Quarin a message, and I presented myself to the house of the merchant and sought entrance therein with my letter and seal. Until today, I do not know the import of the letter, but it does not matter. The merchant was not at home. Thus the door servant admitted me into the house, and I waited all day, growing hungry and thirsty. In the heat of the afternoon, when all about me the house was still and the servant slept, I too felt drowsy. Then before me I saw an apparition in white, a woman young and beautiful, whom I took to be the very wife no man had ever seen. She did not speak, but led me to another room, and there locked the door. I enjoyed her upon the spot. Thus did the afternoon pass quickly, until we heard the master of the house making his return. Immediately the wife arose and departed, having never uttered a word in my presence, and I was left to arrange my garments in some haste. The merchant, Ibn Quarin, found me in the adjoining room, and he viewed me with suspicion, asking why I should be there and not in the courtyard, where it was proper for a messenger to wait. I replied that I was famished and faint, and had searched for food and shade. This was a poor lie, and he did not believe it. He complained to the Caliph, who I know was amused in private, yet compelled to adopt a stern face to the public. Thus, when the ruler of the Sakaliba asked for a mission from the Caliph, this same spiteful Ibn Quarin urged I be sent, and so I was. In our company there was the ambassador of the king of Sakaliba, who was called Abdallah ibn Bastu al-Hazari, a tedious and windy man who talked overmuch. There was also Takin al-Turki, Barz al-Saklabi, both guides on the journey, and I too. We bore gifts for the ruler, for his wife, his children, and his generals. Also we brought certain drugs, which were given over to the care of the Sasan al-Rasi. This was our party. So we started on Thursday, the 11th of Safar, of the year 309, June 21st, 921, from the City of Peace. We stopped a day in Narawan, and from there went swiftly until we reached Al-Daskara, where we stopped for 3 days. Then we travelled straight onward without any detours until we reached Hulwan. There we stayed 2 days. From there we went to Quirmisin, where we remained 2 days.
This passage gives the flavor of Ibn Fadlan's descriptions of travel. Perhaps a quarter of his entire manuscript is written in this fashion, simply listing the names of settlements and the number of days spent at each. Most of this material has been deleted. Apparently, Ibn Fadlan's party is traveling northward, and eventually they are required to halt for winter.
Our stay in Gurgania was lengthy. We stayed there some days of the month of Ragab, November, and during the whole of Saban, Ramadan, and Sawal. Our long stay was brought about by the cold and its bitterness. In this extremity of cold, I saw that the earth sometimes forms great cracks, and a large and ancient tree may split in two halves from this. About the middle of Sawal, of the year 309, February 922, the weather began to change, the river thawed, and we got ourselves the necessary things for the journey. We bought Turkish camels and skin boats made out of camel hides, in preparation for the rivers we would have to cross in the land of the Turks. We laid in a supply of bread, millet, and salted meat for 3 months. Each of us put on a jacket, over that a coat, over that a tulip, over that a burqa, and a helmet of felt, out of which only the two eyes could look. The doctor of the law and the teacher and the pages who travelled with us from Baghdad departed from us now, fearing to enter this new country. So I, the ambassador, his brother-in-law, and two pages, Takin and Barz, proceeded.
Throughout the manuscript, Ibn Fadlan is inexact about the size and composition of his party. He never states that his party is greater than a few individuals, when in fact it probably numbered 100 people or more, and twice as many horses and camels. But Ibn Fadlan literally does not count slaves and servants, and lesser members of the caravan.
The caravan was ready to start, and trusting in the all-powerful and exalted God, we started on Monday, the 3rd of Dukalka, of the year 309, March 3rd, 922, from the town of Gergonia. That same day, we stopped at the burg called Zamgan, that is, the gateway to the Turks. The next morning, we proceeded to Git. There, so much snow fell that the camels plunged in it up to their knees. Hence, we halted 2 days. Then we sped straight into the land of the Turks without meeting anyone on the barren steppe. We rode every day from midnight until the time of the afternoon prayer, and then we halted. When we had ridden 15 nights in this manner, we arrived at a large mountain. From this place we crossed on until we reached a Turkish tribe, which is called the Oghuz. The Oghuz are nomads and have houses of felt. Although they lead a hard existence, they are like asses gone astray. They have no religious bonds with God. They never pray, but instead call their headmen lords. Their undertakings are based upon counsel solely among themselves. I have heard them say, "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet of Allah." But they speak thus so as to get close to any Muslims, and not because they believe it. The ruler of the Oghuz Turks is called Yabgu. That is the name of the ruler, and everyone who rules over this tribe bears the name. His subordinate is always called Kudarkin, and so each subordinate to the chieftain is called Kudarkin. The Oghuz do not wash themselves after either defecation or urination, nor do they bathe after ejaculation or on other occasions. They have nothing whatever to do with water. Oghuz women never veil themselves in the presence of their own men or others, nor does the woman cover any of her bodily parts in the presence of any person. Adultery is unknown among them. Whomsoever they find to be an adulterer, they tear him in two. This comes about so. They bring together the branches of 2 trees, tie him to the branches, and then let both trees go. The custom of pederasty is counted by the Turks a terrible sin. All the Turks pluck beards with the exception of their mustaches. At length we travelled on in the Turkish kingdom, and we travelled forth until we came to the river Bagindi. There we took our skin boats, which had been made from camel hides, spread them out, and loaded the goods from the Turkish camels. When each boat was full, a group of 5, 6, or 4 men sat in them. They took birchwood branches in their hands and used them like oars. Finally we got across. With regard to the horses and camels, they came swimming across. Thus we crossed the river Bagindi and the river called Gam in the same way. Then the Odil, then the Arden, then the Wars, then the Ati, then the Wubna. All these are big rivers. Then we arrived at the Pekenegs. They are dark brown, powerful people, and the men shave their beards. They are poor in contrast to the Oghuz, for I saw men among the Oghuz who possessed 10,000 horses and 100,000 sheep. But the Pekenegs are poor, and we remained only a day with them. Then we started out and came to the river Gaya. This is the largest, widest, swiftest that we saw. Verily I saw how a skin boat overturned in it, and those on it were drowned. Many of the company perished, and a number of the camels and horses were drowned. At length we arrived in the land of the Baskirs.
Ibn Fadlan suggests the Baskirs are not worth bothering with, an uncharacteristic statement from this relentlessly curious traveler.
At length we left the land of the Baskirs and crossed the river Girmsan, the river Urn, the river Wittig, the river Nabasin, then the river Gausin. Between the rivers that we mention, the distance is a journey of 2, 3, or 4 days in each case. Then we came to the land of the Bulgars, which begins at the shore of the river Volga. I saw with my own eyes how the Northmen had arrived with their wares and pitched their camp along the Volga. Never did I see a people so gigantic. They are tall as palm trees, and florid and ruddy in complexion. They wear neither camisoles nor caftans, but the men among them wear a garment of rough cloth. which is thrown over one side so that one hand remains free. Every Northman carries an axe, a dagger, and a sword, and without these weapons they are never seen. Their swords are broad, with wavy lines, and of Frankish make. From the tip of the fingernails to the neck, each man of them is tattooed with pictures of trees, living beings, and other things. The women carry, fastened to their breast, a little case of iron, copper, silver, or gold, according to the wealth and resources of their husbands. Fastened to the case they wear a ring, and upon that a dagger, all attached to their breast. About their necks they wear gold and silver chains. They are the filthiest race that God ever created. They do not wipe themselves after going to stool, or wash themselves after a nocturnal pollution, any more than if they were wild asses. They come from their own country, anchor their ships in the Volga, which is a great river, and build large wooden houses on its banks. In every such house there live 10 or 20. Each man has a couch where he sits with the beautiful girls he has for sale. He is as likely as not to enjoy one of them while a friend looks on. At times several of them will be thus engaged at the same moment, each in full view of the others. Every morning a slave girl comes and brings a tub of water and places it before her master. He proceeds to wash his face and hands, and then his hair, combing it over the vessel. Thereupon he blows his nose and spits into the tub, and leaving no dirt behind, conveys it all into this water. When he has finished, the girl carries the tub to the man next to him, who does the same. Thus she continues until each of those who are in the house has blown his nose and spit into the tub and washed his face and hair. This is the normal way of things among the Northmen, as I have seen with my own eyes. Yet at the period of our arrival among them, there was some discontent among the giant people, the nature of which was thus. Their principal chieftain, a man of the name Wiglif, had fallen ill, and was set up in a sick tent at a distance from the camp, with bread and water. No one approached or spoke to him, or visited him the whole time. No slave nurtured him, for the Northmen believe that a man must recover from any sickness according to his own strength. Many among them believed that Wiglif would never return to join them in the camp, but instead would die. Now one of their number, a young noble called Bulawif, was chosen to be their new leader, but he was not accepted while the sick chieftain still lived. This was the cause of uneasiness at the time of our arrival. Yet also there was no aspect of sorrow or weeping among the people encamped on the Volga. The Northmen place great importance on the duty of the host. They greet every visitor with warmth and hospitality, much food and clothing, and the earls and nobles compete for the honor of the greatest hospitality. The party of our caravan was brought before Bulawif, and a great feast was given us. Over this Bulawif himself presided, and I saw him to be a tall man and strong, with skin and hair and beard of pure white. He had the bearing of a leader. Recognizing the honor of the feast, our party made a show of eating, yet the food was vile, and the manner of the feast contained much throwing of food and drink, and great laughing and merriment. It was common in the middle of this rude banquet for an earl to disport with a slave girl in full view of his fellows. Seeing this, I turned away and said, "I beg God's pardon," and the Northmen laughed much at my discomfiture. One of their number translated for me that they believe God looks favorably upon such open pleasures. He said to me, "You Arabs are like old women. You tremble at the sight of life." I said in answer, "I am a guest among you, and Allah shall lead me to righteousness." This was reason for greater laughter, but I do not know for what cause they should find a joke. The custom of the Northmen reveres the life of war. Verily, these huge men fight continually. They are never at peace, neither among themselves nor among different tribes of their kind. They sing songs of their warfare and bravery, and believe that the death of a warrior is the highest honor. At the banquet of Bulawif, a member of their kind sang a song of bravery and battle that was much enjoyed, though little attended. The strong drink of the Northmen soon renders them as animals and stray asses. In the midst of the song, there was ejaculation, and also mortal combat over some intoxicated quarrel of two warriors. The bard did not cease his song through all these events. Verily, I saw flying blood spatter his face, and yet he wiped it away without a pause in his singing. This impressed me greatly. Now it happened that this Bulawif, who was as drunk as the rest, commanded that I should sing a song for them. Not wishing to anger him, I recited from the Quran, with the translator repeating my words in their Norse tongue. I was received no better than their own minstrel, and afterward I asked the forgiveness of Allah for the treatment of his holy words. We had stayed 2 days among the Northmen, and on the morning we planned to leave, we were told by the translator that the chieftain Wiglif had died. I sought to witness what then befell. First they laid him in his grave, over which a roof was erected, for the space of 10 days, until they had completed the cutting and sewing of his clothes. They also brought together his goods and divided them into 3 parts. The first of these is for his family. The second is expended for the garments they make, and with the third they purchase strong drink, against the day when a girl resigns herself to death and is burned with her master. To the use of wine they abandon themselves in mad fashion, drinking it day and night, as I have already said. Not seldom does one die with a cup in his hand. The family of Wiglif asked of all his girls and pages, "Which of you will die with him?" Then one of them answered, "I." From the time she uttered that word, she was no longer free. Should she wish to draw back, she is not permitted. The girl who spoke was then committed to 2 other girls, who were to keep watch over her. During the whole of this period, the girl gave herself over to drinking and singing, and was cheerful and gay. During this time, Bulawif found a rival whose name was Thorkel. Him I did not know, but he was ugly and foul, a dark man among this ruddy, fair race. He plotted to be chieftain himself. All this I learned from the translator, for there was not outward sign in the funeral preparations that anything was not according to custom. Bulawif himself did not direct the preparations, for he was not of the family of Wiglif. Bulawif joined in the general merriment and celebration, and acted no part of kingly conduct, except during the banquets of the night, when he sat in the high seat that was reserved for the king. This was the manner of his sitting. When a Northman is truly king, he sits at the head of the table in a large stone chair with stone arms. Such was the chair of Wiglif. But Bulawif did not sit in it as a normal man would sit. Instead, he sat upon one arm, a position from which he fell when he drank overmuch, or laughed with great excess. It was the custom that he could not sit in the chair until Wiglif was buried. All this time, Thorkel plotted and conferred among the other earls. I came to know that I was suspected as some sorcerer or witch, which distressed me much. The translator, who did not believe these tales, told me that Thorkel said I had caused Wiglif to die, and had caused Bulawif to be the next chief. Yet verily I had no part in any of this. After some days, I sought to leave with my party of Ibn Bastu and Takin and Bars, and yet the Northmen would not permit us to leave, saying that we must stay to the funeral, and threatening us with their daggers. Thus we stayed. When the day was come that Wiglif and the girl were to be committed to the flames, his ship was drawn ashore on the banks of the river. Next they brought a couch, placed it in the ship, and covered it with Greek cloth of gold. There then came an old crone, whom they call the Angel of Death, and she spread the personal articles on the couch. It was she who was to slay the girl. I saw the crone with my own eyes. She was dark, thick-set, with a lowering countenance. When they came to the grave, they removed the roof and drew out the dead man. Then I saw that he had turned quite black by reason of the coldness of that country. Now I saw Bulawif and Thorkell standing side by side, making a great show of friendship during the burial ceremony. And yet it was apparent that there was no truth to their appearances. The dead king was now clothed in a caftan of gold cloth. Then he was carried to a tent in the ship. They seated him on a quilted couch, supported him with pillows, and brought strong drink, fruits, and basil, which they placed alongside him. Then they brought a dog, which they cut in two and threw into the ship. They laid all his weapons beside him, and led up two horses, whereupon Bulawif killed one with his sword, and Thorkell killed the second, cutting them into pieces with their swords, and flinging the pieces forth into the ship. The girl who had devoted herself to death, meanwhile, walked to and fro, entering one after another of the tents that they had there. The occupant of each tent lay with her, saying, "Tell your master I did this only for love of him." Now it was late in the afternoon. They led the girl away to the ship, but did not yet admit her to the tent. Now the men came up with shields and staves, and handed her a cup of strong drink. This she took, and sang over it, and emptied it. The interpreter told me, she said, "With this I take leave of those who are dear to me." Then another cup was handed to her. The crone admonished her to drain the cup without lingering, and to enter the tent where her master lay. By this time it seemed to me the girl had become dazed. She made as though she would enter the tent, when suddenly the hag seized her by the head and dragged her in. At this moment the men began to beat upon their shields with the staves, in order to drown the noise of her outcries, which might have terrified the other girls and deterred them from seeking death with their masters in the future. Six men followed her into the tent, and each and every one of them had carnal companionship with her. Then they laid her down by her master's side, while two of the men seized her feet, and two the hands. The old woman, known as the Angel of Death, now knotted a rope around her neck, and handed the ends to two of the men to pull. Then, with a broad-bladed dagger, she smote her between the ribs, and she drew the blade forth, while the two men strangled her with the rope till she died. The kin of the dead Wiglaf now drew near, and taking a piece of lighted wool, walked backward naked toward the ship, and ignited the ship without ever looking at it. The funeral pyre was soon aflame, and the ship, the tent, the man, and the girl, and everything else, blew up in a blazing storm of fire. At my side, one of the Northmen made some comment to the interpreter. I asked the interpreter what was said, and received this answer. "You Arabs," he said, "must be a stupid lot. You take your most beloved and revered man and cast him into the ground to be devoured by creeping things and worms. We, on the other hand, burn him in a twinkling, so that instantly, without a moment's delay, he enters into paradise." And in truth, before an hour had passed, ship, wood, and girl had, with the man, turned to ashes. These Scandinavians find no cause for grief in any man's death. On the same evening of the funeral of the chief called Wiglaf, there was great feasting in the halls of the Northmen encampment. Yet I perceived that all was not fitting among these barbarians. I sought counsel with my interpreter. He responded thusly, "It is the plan of Thorkell to see you die, and then to banish Bulawif. Thorkell has gathered the support of some earls to himself.
but there is dispute in every house and every quarter.
Much distressed, I said, I have no part in this affair. How shall I act? The interpreter said I should flee if I could, but if I were caught, this would be proof of my guilt, and I would be treated as a thief. A thief is treated in this fashion. The Northmen lead him to a thick tree, fasten a strong rope about him, string him up, and let him hang until he rots to pieces by the action of the wind and rain. I chose to remain among the Northmen until I should be given free passage to continue on my journey. I inquired of the interpreter whether I should bear gifts to Bulliwith, and also to Thorkell, to favor my departure. He said that I could not bear gifts to both, and that the matter was undecided who would be the new chieftain. Then he said it would be clear in one day and night, and no longer. For it is true among these Northmen that they have no established way of choosing a new chief when the old leader dies. Strength of arms counts high, but also allegiances of the warriors and the earls and noblemen. In some cases there is no clear successor to the rule, and this was one of such eventualities. My interpreter said that I should bide my time and also pray. This I did. Then there came a great storm on the banks of the river Volga, a storm that persisted 2 days, with a driving rain and forceful winds, and after this storm a cold mist lay on the ground. It was thick and white, and a man could not see past a dozen paces. Now these same giant Northmen warriors, who by virtue of their enormity and strength of arms and cruel disposition have nothing to fear in all the world, yet these men fear the mist or fog that comes with storms. The men of their race are at some pains to conceal their fear, even one from another. The warriors laugh and joke overmuch, and make unreasonable display of carefree emotion. Thus do they prove the reverse, and in truth their attempt is childish. So plainly do they pretend not to see the truth, yet verily each and all of them, throughout their encampment, are making prayers and sacrifices of hen and cocks, and if a man is asked the reason of the sacrifice, he will say, I make sacrifice for the safety of my faraway family, or he will say, I make sacrifice in honor of such or another deceased member of my family, or he will say many other reason, and then he will add, and also for the lifting of the mist. Now I accounted it strange for such strong and warlike people to be so fearful of anything as to pretend a lack of fear. And of all the sensible reasons for fear, mist or fog seemed to my way of thinking very greatly inexplicable. I said to my interpreter that a man could fear wind, or blasting storms of sand, or water floods, or heaving of the ground, or thunder and lightning within the sky, for all of these could injure a man, or kill him, or ruin his dwelling. Yet I said that fog or mist contained no threat of harm. In truth, it was the least of any form of changing elements. The interpreter answered to me that I was lacking the beliefs of a sailor. He said that many Arab sailors agreed with the Northmen in the matter of uneasiness within the wrapping of mist. So also, he said, all seafarers are made anxious of any mist or fog, because such a condition increases the peril of travel upon the waters. I said this was sensible, but that when the mist lay upon the land and not the water, I did not understand the reason for any fear. To this the interpreter replied, the fog is always feared whenever it comes. And he said that it made no difference on land or water according to the Northman view. And then he said to me the Northmen did not truly much fear the mist. Also the interpreter said that he, as a man, did not fear the mist. He said that it was only a minor matter of slight consequence. He said, it is as a minor ache inside a limb joint, which may come with fog, but no more important. By this I saw that my interpreter, among the others, denied all manner of concern for the fog, and feigned indifference. In this same day there arrived a Northman boat, containing a noble of their own race. He was a young man with a thin beard, and he traveled with only a small party of pages and slaves. This same visitor beached his boat and remained standing with it until nightfall, and no man came near to him or greeted him, although he was a stranger and in plain sight to all. My interpreter said,
"He is a kin of Bulewif, and he will be received at the night banquet."
I said, "Why does he stay at his ship?"
"Because of the mist. It is the custom he must stand in view for many hours, so all can see him and know he is no enemy coming from the mist."
This the interpreter said to me with much hesitation. At the night banquet, I saw the young man come into the hall. Here he was warmly greeted, and with much display of surprise, and in this most especially by Bulewif, who acted as if the young man had just arrived and had not been standing by his ship many hours. After the several greetings, the youth spoke a passionate speech, which Bulewif attended with unusual interest. He did not drink and dally with the slave girls, but instead, in silence, heard the youth, who spoke in a high and cracking voice. At the finish of the tale, the youth seemed about to have tears, and was given a cup of drink. I inquired of my interpreter what was said.
"He is Wulfgar, and he is the son of Hrothgar, a great king in the north. He is kin of Bulewif, and seeks his aid and support on a hero's mission. Wulfgar says the far country suffers a dread and nameless terror, which all the peoples are powerless to oppose. And he asks Bulewif to make haste to return to the far country and save his people and the kingdom of his father, Hrothgar."
I inquired of the interpreter the nature of this terror.
"It has no name which I can tell."
The interpreter seemed much disturbed by Wulfgar's words, and so also were many other Northmen. I inquired of the interpreter details of the menace.
"The name cannot be said, for it is forbidden to speak it, lest the utterance of the name call forth the demons."
And as he spoke, I saw that he was fearful just to think upon these matters, and his pallor was marked, and so I ended my inquiry. Bulewif, sitting at the high stone throne, was silent. Never had I seen the merry and rambunctious North people so subdued. Then into the hall entered the old crone called the Angel of Death, and she sat beside Bulewif. From a hide bag she withdrew some bones, whether human or animal I do not know, and these bones she cast upon the ground, speaking low utterances, and she passed her hand over them. The bones were gathered up and cast again, and the process repeated with more incantations. Now again was the casting done, and finally she spoke to Bulewif. Then Bulewif stood and raised his cup of strong drink, and called to the assembled earls and warriors, making a speech of some good length. One by one, several warriors stood at their places to face him. Not all stood. I counted 11. And Bulewif pronounced himself satisfied with this. Now also I saw that Thorkell appeared much pleased by the proceedings, and assumed a more kingly bearing, while Bulewif paid him no heed, or showed any hatred of him, or even any interest, although they were formerly enemies a few minutes past. Then the Angel of Death pointed to me, and made some utterance, and then she departed the hall. Now at last my interpreter spoke.
"Bulewif is called by the gods to leave this place, and swiftly, putting behind him all his cares and concerns, to act as a hero to repel the menace in the north. This is fitting, and he must also take 11 warriors with him, and so also must he take you."
I said that I was on a mission to the Bulgars and must follow the instructions of my caliph with no delay.
"The Angel of Death has spoken. The party of Bulewif must be 13, and of these one must be no Northman, and so you shall be the 13th.
I protested that I was not a warrior. Verily, I made all the excuses and pleadings that I could imagine might have effect upon this rude company of beings. I demanded the interpreter convey my words to Bulewif, and yet he turned away and left the hall, saying this last speech.
"Prepare yourself as you think best. You shall leave on the morning light.